Good morning, Hugh Thatcher, 32661, appearing on behalf of appellant Arbor Contract Carpet. With me at council table, I have Arbor Representative Matt Gilbreth. This case is before the court on appeal from the decision of the Industrial Claim Appeals Office, affirming a determination by the Division of Employment and Training that certain persons providing flooring installation services to Arbor Contract Carpet are misclassified and are in fact employees for purposes of the Colorado Employment Security Act. There are three issues before the court today. First, did the ICAO panel err when it concluded that the determination by the division was correct and these persons providing flooring services were in fact employees for purposes of the Colorado Employment Security Act? And on this basis, Arbor would ask that the court reverse the ICAO panel because the great weight of the evidence at hearing established that Arbor has satisfied its burden under CRS 870-115 and established that these persons are free of Arbor's direction and control and that they were customarily engaged in independent business or trade.
So I'm sorry to interrupt, but before you go too much farther on this argument, I just want to clarify one point. The way you have characterized that issue and the way it is argued in your briefs, you don't talk about an issue that was apparently argued and ruled on at the panel stage, and that is this presumption if you have a written contract. Am I correct that, at least for purposes of this appeal, that's an issue that we don't have in front of us, and it's simply the question of the two-prong test about proving whether these people are independent contractors or employees?
That is correct, Your Honor. At this point, Arbor is not arguing that the presumption should apply to this particular agreement.
Great. Sorry to interrupt.
In the alternative, if the court chooses to affirm the decision of the ICAO panel, there are two issues that Arbor would like the court to address today. The first is, did the panel err when it refused to hear Arbor's argument that the amount of insurance premiums due and payable because of the division's determination should be reduced? And second, did the panel err when it did not hear the argument offered before the panel that Arbor was prejudiced by the four-month delay between the administrative hearing in this matter and the decision issued by the hearing officer? I think the briefs are quite abundant with references to the record. We've tried to give the court a roadmap to decide this case and to prove that Arbor has satisfied its burden under 870 CRS, CRS 870-115. And so what I'd like to do is confine my comments this morning on that particular argument to what I perceive to be the core of the decision of the panel and the hearing officer below. And that is the interpretation of the contract that Arbor utilizes with its independent contractor installers. It appears from the reasoning in the ICAO panel decision, as well as the hearing officer decision, that both bodies looked exclusively to the four corners of a document that is called the project agreement. And the reason for this is not clear, because the project agreement is not the entire contract that Arbor utilizes with its installers.
Interrupt you. Were purchase orders admitted into evidence at the hearing?
I believe there was oral testimony regarding the purchase orders.
But there's no copies of the purchase orders. There's not even a sample of them. I searched the record this morning. I couldn't find a purchase order in the record. There isn't one there, is there?
I believe there's verbal testimony only.
Okay. I thought I was lost, but maybe that explains part of the ALJ's or the judge's confusion, because I don't know what the purchase order says.
It very well could be. And okay. I think that the paragraph that's really at issue here in the project agreement is paragraph 10.2. And paragraph 10.2 makes quite clear that further terms must be agreed upon between the installer and Arbor before there is a contract. Quite simply, there is no purchase price in this agreement. There is no quantity of flooring to be installed. There is no price for the flooring that is to be installed. All those must be agreed upon later. And I think standing alone, the project agreement is an agreement to agree.
No, but when you say these things were to be agreed upon later on, isn't the testimony really that those things were decided by Arbor and put out there, and if somebody was there who wanted to take a particular job, they raised their hand and they took it. I mean, the price was, there's no evidence that the price was ever negotiated. There's no evidence that the size of the job was ever negotiated. It was a job that Arbor had, and they put it out for whoever was there and wanted to take it. Isn't that the evidence?
I believe that is the evidence, Your Honor.
So there's no, when you say there was an, you know, you had to look later on to see if there was an agreement on price and things like that. I mean, I guess, you know, maybe there's an agreement in that sense, but there certainly wasn't a back and forth about what those terms were to be, was there?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, except that what I would point out is that these installers have to use their independent business judgment about whether they can make money off a job or no. And that means they have to look at the price that's being offered for the flooring, whether it be commercial carpet. I believe the evidence showed there was a different rate for commercial carpet or residential carpet. They'll have to look at the quantity of carpet they're going to be installing, whether it's one room or an entire apartment complex. They have to look at where that apartment complex is located, whether it's in Fort Collins or where it's closer to the project headquarters in Colorado Springs. And they have to make a business decision based on those numbers about whether they can make a profit on that job or not.
Is there evidence in the record that installers actually went through that thought process as opposed to just saying, I need work, I'll take it?
I don't believe there's any evidence from an installer that they went through that thought process. I think it's a reasonable inference from the record, however, given the experience and the business acumen that these installers who testified did show, and that they would go through such a process in order to maintain a profitable business.
Now, so that raises another question that I have, and I must say I'm kind of bemused by this whole issue, and that is, how does an employer go? And I'm really talking about the independent trade and business prong here. How do you go about proving up your case when you have dozens, maybe in some cases hundreds, of employees? You put on four witnesses here, and then one witness from your company who the hearing officer basically made a credibility judgment and said, I don't buy his testimony. So how do you put on your case with respect to 57 people?
Well, I think that's a very good question, Your Honor, and I think it's a difficult proposition for any employer faced with that position. I mean, certainly an employer could try and call every single independent contractor in these circumstances. I think the record does show, however, that the hearing officer was not inclined to hear more than four witnesses from Arbor Contract Carpet. And so Arbor did comply with what the hearing officer asked for, and presented those witnesses, and asked that the evidence from those witnesses be attributable to other installers.
One legitimate inference that one could draw is that, well, you called the four witnesses who are most likely to be engaged in independent business or trade, but not necessarily the others. I wonder if there were steps that you could have taken to insulate yourself from that inference. Could you have offered, given a written offer of proof that any of the other witnesses were in the same position, that all of the other witnesses were, or any of the other witnesses were available by phone, and that if you called any at random, you would get testimony to much the same effect?
Yeah, I think there are processes that an employer can go through. To be candid with the court, however, there's not a lot of guidance from this court or from the division itself about how these hearings are supposed to be conducted when you're involving large numbers of independent contractors. In those circumstances, I think the employer has to take their best shot and provide what they think will prove their case, and then leave it to the hearing officer.
You knew at the outset that all 57 were at issue, did you not? You were on notice of that.
I don't believe we were on notice, Your Honor. That was one of the very beginning issues. If you look at the record, it's parsed between a May hearing and a June hearing. If you look at the record in the May hearing, there was considerable confusion about what installers were subject to the determination of the division.
Did you put on some kind of evidence as to, you called five, I think, four or five testified. I think it was a fifth one. She wasn't so helpful. But anyway, as the other 52, what evidence, if any, did Arbor put in that these people had independent trader business? Was there any?
I believe the only evidence was that of the installation manager.
Silva.
And that was expressly discredited by the hearing officer in the written decision.
But she didn't put in their project agreements or some other evidence that those people also were free to work in other trades or businesses while also bidding on Arbor jobs.
I believe there were two exemplar agreements that were offered, Your Honor. One was offered by the division, and that mirrors that which was offered into evidence by Arbor.
No summary, no kind of summary that these people work X number of hours for us and X number of hours elsewhere. There was nothing, no summary exhibit or anything like that.
There was not, Your Honor, and from a pure evidential standpoint, in terms of the business record, you know, if it existed, perhaps an employer could offer that into evidence. But if it didn't already exist, then there might be some issues in presenting that.
Counsel, Mr. Thatcher, I am intrigued by your observation that there was some confusion about whether the all 57 were going to be at issue. Is it your position that you were not given a fair opportunity to produce evidence on these?
No, Your Honor. I believe that the record as it stands is adequate. And that is one of the fundamental issues, I think, that's addressed in the brief, in that the four installers who did testify on behalf of Arbor, who did offer evidence about the nature of their independent business, provide substantial evidence in the record from which the hearing officer could conclude that, in fact, this should be attributable to other installers.
Agreed. Absolutely. But if does the evidence necessarily compel that inference, necessarily compel that conclusion, or was the officer free, as she did, to disbelieve the testimony of the supervisor and conclude that there's a failure of proof as to the others?
Well, then I guess the question in my mind, Your Honor, is whether the evidence introduced by the division is substantial enough to allow the hearing officer to render that conclusion. Because the absence of evidence, I think, is problematic in this particular matter.
I guess that's the corollary of what Judge Russell is asking. I mean, you've got the burden of proof. And so putting aside Silva's testimony, I guess the division's argument would be you put on testimony of four witnesses, and at least on the independent trade and business prong, you won. For those four witnesses on their specific cases, they would say we don't have a responsibility to put on any evidence with respect to the other 53 or so.
Well, if I may suggest an alternative to the court, the hearing officer decided that the evidence from those four installers is not attributable to any other installer. Arbor's position preferably would be that it be attributed to all installers. But at the very least, there is precedent to say that that evidence should be attributable to all other installers in a similar situation. That isn't the cases before this court. I will very briefly address the two alternative arguments that Arbor is presenting this morning in the event that the court chooses to affirm the decision of the panel. The first is that heart of this issue involves a determination by the division, and that includes whether or not these persons are employees for purposes of the act and how much money in premiums Arbor pays. The ICAO refused to hear that argument, said it wasn't before the hearing officer. I didn't read anything in the statute that allows for two appeals out of a determination, one to challenge the determination itself and one to challenge the amount of insurance premiums that are due and payable pursuant to it.
Let me ask you a practical question. If this panel were, for whatever reason, to decide either wholly or in part to set aside the thrust of them, the merits of the order, and send it back, does the issue that you're now arguing go away, because then you'd have a chance to argue what the proper amount of the premium should be?
I believe it would, Your Honor. That's the opportunity that Arbor is looking for at this point in time. The same issue goes with the prejudicial nature of the delay between the hearing officer decision and the issuance of the order. Right now, Arbor's just looking for the opportunity to make a record. Arbor hasn't had that at this point in time. The panel refused to hear the argument.
Does that relate just to the amount of interest, if I understand your argument correctly? The delay just relates to the calculation of interest on the premium? Could you just briefly explain that? Because I don't quite get it. When did the amount become due? And when did the interest start to run? And how did the delay hurt you?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that the amount became due and payable as of the day it should have been paid in 2006, 2007, or 2008, and it runs from that point forward.
So, have you paid it to date?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
So how does the four-month delay hurt you? I mean, the fact that the administrative law judge delayed 4 months her decision, and the interest is running during that time, but even since she's decided, you haven't paid the amount, so the interest is still running. So what's the difference if there was a four-month delay or not?
I guess that would be 4 months of additional interest that Arbor would prefer not to pay.
You want them to carve out the 4 months and then start the clock running again from the day of her decision?
That'd be one option, Your Honor, yes.
Oh, okay.
And with that, I will reserve my remaining 30 seconds for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thatcher.
Please, the court. My name is Lee Higner, registration number 42. I'm appearing today for the Industrial Claim Appeals Office, which we refer characteristically as the panel. The first thing we'd like to cite that we cited in our brief here, this is an issue of whether or not the panel committed error when it endorsed the findings of the hearing officer. Our concern here is whether or not there is no basis for the determination made by the panel. That's the whole issue as we see it, and have suggested that the standard for review in this matter is 874-1076. Council apparently do not agree with that. They have suggested that the standard of review in this case is something other than that. And the only matter here we contend before the court is whether or not the panel committed error. That leads to considerations this court has characteristically made as to whether or not the panel is free to overturn or revisit the factual determinations made by the hearing officer. And there's a, I believe the court will agree that there is ample evidence, ample case law in Colorado to suggest that the standard of review when applied here suggests that error is only committed by the panel if there's no factual basis for the determination that the panel has made to be found in the record established by the hearing officer. The panel can't change the factual findings made by the hearing officer unless and under certain, unless the circumstances apply that there's nothing in the record to support the conclusions drawn by the hearing officer. We think that there's a great deal. There are three arguments that have been raised here on appeal that were not raised before the hearing officer. And you are asked to address those. The last that was mentioned by counsel is that the hearing officer was presented with a proposition as to the calculation of interest. That's not the hearing officer's duty. The hearing officer's determination is solely whether or not a tax is due. And to suggest that there's been an error here committed by the panel because it agreed that the hearing officer was not obliged to determine what the interest might be and whether penalties might be due is to take the obligation of the hearing officer far beyond the limitations that are created by rules, regulations, or the statute.
Agner, how does this work? After the hearing officer makes a determination, I guess, about liability, how is the amount of interest and the determination of penalties rendered?
I haven't the slightest idea. And because the determination that is made would be, as of a certain date, the obligation was due. There is nothing, to my knowledge, within the with any of the statutory considerations or any of the regulations established by the statute under question here that says this is how and when the taxes will be computed, other than to say from the point of time that the taxes were assessed by the division, the obligation began to run.
Well, let me ask you, the second issue here isn't the interest issue, it's what's the amount that we owe? The as I understand it, when the division made its decision, there was a dollar amount on that. And so what, and then what I understand Arbor is saying is that when they went before both the hearing officer and the panel, they said, look, we don't think we owe anything, but if we owe something, it's not X, it's Y because of this. And the panel didn't decide that. And so I guess the question I have, if it was appropriate for the hearing officer and the panel to beg off on that question, what is there in the statute or the rules or what's the procedure for an employer like Arbor to be able to argue that the number is wrong? And how do they do that?
You ask the division to supply information with regard to how many employees are involved, how many workers were involved. of those workers, how many were to be considered or were considered to be employees. For sake of discussion in this case, there were 57 involved. Four witnesses were called. Even if we were to conclude that the four witnesses whose testimony was taken at the hearing were considered to be independent contractors, then the conclusion is plausible that, and as was stated by the hearing officer, that the others were not.
Yes. That wasn't my question. Let me try to rephrase the question.
It may not be your fault. It may be my inability to grasp.
Well, it's confusing all around. Let's say that the division says, okay, you've got these 57 employees, and you owe us $37,000. And the employer says, okay, I don't necessarily agree with it, but I'm not going to take the time or trouble to make the argument whether I owe anything at all, but I don't like the $37,000 figure. That's what I want to contest. It's the wrong number. What's the procedure for contesting that?
The assessment of the liability or the amount of the tax?
The amount of the tax. That's what I understand they're saying the argument, the second argument is.
That are we here today, do we now say that all 57 were properly determined to be employees?
Yes, assume that. And the division puts a number on that, and they want to dispute what the number is. How do they do that?
But, Judge, what would the basis for the dispute be?
Let's say some mathematical error.
No, calculation error. Or some of it was not wages. Some of it was repayment of overhead, which seems to be their argument.
How do they argue that? What do they do?
I'm sorry, I can't tell you. I don't know, but I believe that the matter would be to go directly to the division, file a protest, request a hearing, seek to have it reviewed, and present the evidence. It would not be to file a lawsuit or raise an issue here. It would be to go and present evidence to the division, and because of my familiarity with the people that are involved in this work at the division, they have this calculated to a penny. And the issue can be resolved by confronting the division with its own calculations.
Oh, so presumably then that the division's answer would be subject to another review by a hearing officer and perhaps later appealed if the employer didn't agree with
If there were a persistent disagreement about the amount.
I see. Oh. So it is separately appealable in your view?
I'm sorry?
It is separately appealable. This is a separate decision that can be put through the administrative process and eventually appealed.
If that's appeal with a small a, yes. You can simply ask for a hearing or call them up and sit down with them and say, I'd like to meet with you and ask you to show us how you arrived at these calculations, how they were determined, and this is what we show, and how do you know this is not the case? Then if no adjustment is made at the division level, then this process can start over under another claim. But that's not the claim which I thought was being discussed here today. The second matter of great concern.
Before it gets away, I'd like to go back to your answer to Judge Loeb's question. You remember your answer? You said that four people testified, and they were arguably found to be independent or independent contractors.
I'm not sure that's true. I think they were not, but even if we accept that to be true.
Okay. And then you said that based on that, the hearing officer could properly infer that the other 53 were employees.
I disagree with counsel's theory that you extrapolate from the testimony of three or four that certain circumstances apply, and therefore that they, on a raised-ipsa-loquitur basis, apply to the remaining individuals who have been named and against whom, or excuse me, in whose regard taxes were imposed.
Tell me, what was the basis for the hearing officer's determination that at least those 53 were employees and not independent contractors?
Because of the failure of the proponent of the theory to prove that these individuals were independent contractors.
The absence of evidence.
Okay.
So in a case like this where there are multiple workers involved, I take it your position is the employer has got to come up with either a witness who can summarize and cover the entire universe of those workers and hope that the hearing officer finds that person credible, or in the absence of that, get some kind of documentary evidence into the record that will cover the other 53 or how many other there are workers as well. And absent that, there's a failure of proof.
That's correct. But Judge Lowe, this case is document intense. This is a case where the proponent of this concept, the appellant, has suggested that this is an inappropriate determination that these individuals were employees and not workers. And it holds up a flag, and it says the flag is the project agreement. And then it comes before this court, and it's on its, in its brief on pages 22 and 23, it raises an argument that says, get the project agreement. That's an undertaking between the parties, excuse me, that's signed annually. They agree to be available for work if we should call them. In their brief, in a matter, in an argument not raised before the panel, they may now make this statement that the actual contract between the parties is something to which they refer as the project agreement. And they tell you that it is sufficiently nonspecific that these workers, it's on page 22 or 23 of their opening brief, they say the actual contract, which should be examined here, is not the project agreement, it's the installation contract. And the installation contract contains not one single earmark of acceptable standard language sufficient to pass muster to show that a proponent for the theory that these individuals are independent contractors in fact are. There is, as a matter of fact, testimony in the record to the effect, excuse me, please, that the phrase trade name has no equivalent in Spanish. There's an obligation here to show that these individuals were independent contractors, and there is a litany of undertakings that people can prove, illustrate, show, saying, I have a separate ID number for a business. I have a separate bank account. I conduct my business as a separate address. They can even bring people into court to say, yes, characteristically, as an independent contractor, I install a carpet for company A, company B, company C, and I derive only 30% of my income from what I am given from Arbor Carpet. Somehow it is passed over to the division to find this information. Somehow the division is supposed to say, oh, we see you could have done it. Where? We're still looking at evidence. And an argument is now raised after the hearing, which says, well, actually the contract here that is subject to scrutiny is something known as the installation contract. And the fact of the matter is the court has reviewed the record here. Counsel has argued to you that it is the obligation that these independent contractors will look at the work order. They will go somewhere to determine the extent of the amount of carpet that they have been given and make a definitive judgment as to whether or not, based on the work order, they can install the quantity of carpet that they have been given, the quantity of the carpet is sufficient, and that they can install it in the time allocated by the work order. Only one problem. The first time they see the unit in which the carpet is to be installed is when they take the carpet to the site. That's the primary flaw here, to suggest that exercising your independent judgment, these individuals who say they would like work when they can get it are given work orders at 7 o'clock in the morning or 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, depending upon how many show up, and told, do you want to do this job? If you do, you take this carpet here, here's the work order, go do the work, stay where you are, call us when you think you've finished, we'll determine whether or not you have installed a carpet according to the work order, and to be certain that we don't have to send somebody back to finish this job, we're going to withhold 10%, I believe, I'm not certain, from the amount of money that you think you're entitled to receive.
Counsel, though, it's pretty clear that when they go in the morning, they're free to say, no, I don't feel like doing that job today.
How would they know based on the state, excuse me for interrupting Judge Russell, but how would they know based on what counsel has told you? Certainly, they're free to say, I don't want to do the work, and many perhaps do. But it isn't a sophisticated determination that the amount of carpet on the truck, the amount of tax strip that may be made available to them, and the appropriate carpet has been loaded on the truck. They might say, I don't want to do it. But they're exercising their discretion and their wisdom or their intelligence to do what?
Maybe on the basis of imperfect information, but it seems to me that fundamentally that decision is different from the employee relationship who plays regularly, don't feel like doing the work that day, but they still have to do it.
Yeah, I understand that. These people still have to do it if they want to eat.
Thank you, Mr. Hegner.
Thank you very much.
Is that you? You just got a few seconds, but it's all yours.
I will be brief, Your Honor. Thank you. This has to do with the second issue. If the court tells Arbor that the amount of premiums due is not at issue in this case, and my client is free to file a separate appeal from the determination challenging the amount due, and my client will not be stopped from making that challenge, then Arbor will be satisfied with that result. The issue here is when Arbor will be able to make that argument. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel for your excellent arguments. Case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course.